Welcome to Sound Off 122, here for the 22nd of August, 2010, here on SCScoops.com. I am the Solemn Monster. Thank you, as always, for downloading the podcast, and got a lot of television thoughts for you people this week. A rare week where I was able to catch Raw, NXT, Impact, and SmackDown. And while there are some good stuff, there are some good things, rather, I should say, that were in there, and I'll talk about that. There was also a lot of bad stuff, and we're definitely going to cover all those things. So we'll get into the television thoughts, and then we have some other bits of news to get to here. So let's just get right into it. Let's go back to the beginning of the week. Now, for those of you who missed it, or maybe asking yourself, Solomonster, your math is a little off. This is actually episode 121. That would be incorrect. Episode 121 went up on Monday last week. I gave my post-pay-per-view SummerSlam thoughts. I did order the show. It was not worth the $44.95 I invested in it. It was a good show, okay show at best. So if you want to go back and hear my thoughts on SummerSlam and some other news bits kind of sprinkled in there, Sound Off 121 actually went up on Monday, and it is available for download. It's actually one of the more highly downloaded shows that I've done in quite some time, so go back, check that out. So Raw Monday Night, coming off the heels of SummerSlam, what would they do to rehabilitate the Nexus storyline? Because obviously Nexus really lost a lot of steam at the pay-per-view. They lost to Team WWE. You know, when I did my predictions for the pay-per-view, the big question was, how would Nexus win? The conclusion of that match, would it be a team member on John Cena's team that would turn on him? Because nobody really expected Nexus to get the clean victory. Well, nobody expected Nexus to lose, period, but that's exactly what happened, and it was the wrong move, in my opinion. You just unnecessarily ran the risk of weakening the Nexus. If you're going to continue this for a couple of more months, why run the risk of weakening them at all? You know, I just don't think it was worth the risk just to give people a happy ending at the end of a pay-per-view. So basically, the show-long storyline on Monday's show is Wade Barrett and the members of Nexus each in a series of one-on-one matches. There was a tag match in there, Skip Sheffield and David Otunga against R-Truth and John Morrison, but basically, if any member of Nexus lost their respective match, they would be out of the group so that they can rid themselves of the weak link in the faction. Fair enough. Wade Barrett starts the show off one-on-one with Chris Jericho. Again, a couple of minutes. It wasn't a terribly long match. It wasn't even a terribly good match, to be perfectly honest with you. I mean, Barrett didn't, you know, he wasn't offensive in there, but obviously he's still pretty green. What I loved about this was, leave it to Chris Jericho to put somebody over strong. Barrett, as it turned out, would be the only member of Nexus to win his match pretty much fair and square and be made to look at least somewhat dominant in victory, which he should be since he's the leader of the faction. Unfortunately, the same cannot be said for the other members of Nexus, who were pretty much, even though they all but Darren Young won their respective bouts, all were made to look pretty impotent, let's be honest. You had Michael Tarver getting a cheap roll-up pinfall on Daniel Bryan, who was distracted by The Miz and Alex Riley, keeping that feud going. You had, as I mentioned earlier, Sheffield and Otunga got a tag team win, with Sheffield really being the one to look dominant and be protected. He looked pretty good in that match. And again, it should be of no surprise. I've said before, I think Skip Sheffield has a big future ahead of him. We'll get to Skip Sheffield in a second, though, some bad Sheffield news in the last couple of days. Heath Slater beating Edge via countout in a match that certainly did not do Edge any favors, making him look like a friggin' idiot. Going for the spear, Slater sidesteps him, rolls back into the ring. Edge just does not care enough, apparently, to roll back into the ring and gets counted out. Of course, we can't have Heath Slater look too strong, though. He gets speared out of his boots by Edge after the match. I thought Slater actually looked pretty decent in this match. He's a good little worker. We had Justin Gabriel, who had selected Bret the Hitman Hart to be his opponent, which begged the question, how in the world were they going to finagle their way out of this match? Because obviously Bret, as good as he looked at SummerSlam for the 60 seconds he was in that ring, cannot work a singles match, especially against somebody 30 years his junior. So they came up with one of the dumbest explanations as far as why Bret Hart would not be wrestling. The anonymous GM, whoever he or she is, decides to announce that they don't like Bret Hart. They never did, and you'll never see him again on Raw. So apparently Bret Hart has been written out yet again for now, and we will not be seeing him anytime soon. So in his place comes Randy Orton, and Orton proceeds to make Gabriel look like a jobber. Justin Gabriel, quite frankly, is another one of those guys. I put him behind Barrett and Sheffield in terms of the way they're being pushed, but I think Gabriel, something, you know, tells me that Gabriel has the potential to be a good babyface character. I guess in due time we'll find out, but Orton has things well in hand, and then Sheamus comes down to keep that feud going, and apparently Orton and Sheamus are going to keep things going through the Hell in a Cell pay-per-view in October, so don't think that Night of Champions will be the end of it. Orton goes and chases after Sheamus. They brawl into the crowd. Orton gets counted out. Gabriel wins. And, of course, later on, he ends up eating an RKO anyway, much like Edge earlier, making Heath Slater look like a complete and total tool. Not a good night for the Nexus, even though they pretty much all but one Nexus member won their match. I don't really think any of them looked particularly strong, except Wade Barrett and maybe Skip Sheffield. We fast forward to the end of the show. Darren Young, or the black version of John Cena, as I like to call him, decides to man up. He picks John Cena as his opponent. Of course, you may recall Cena beat the crap out of Darren Young about a month ago on Raw, put him out of action. Young wanted revenge, and, you know, he got a fair bit of offense in the match. It wasn't a bad match. It really wasn't, but in the end, he taps to the STF. Nexus comes down. John Cena freely escapes, and Nexus proceeds to beat Darren Young down, eating their young. Wade Barrett gives him his finishing move. Gabriel comes off the top with the 450, and apparently that's the end of Darren Young for now. Raw actually taped two shows on Monday night in LA, and without getting into all the spoilers just yet, it does not appear that Darren Young is on the show this upcoming Monday, and I'm not quite sure if he's going to just be sent back down to Florida. I don't know if this is a bad omen for him in terms of his tenure with the company, or if at some point he's going to be brought back as a babyface. I don't know. It wouldn't be the worst thing in the world for him to go back down to developmental, because he's still not quite there yet. But I guess in due time we'll find out. Better for him to go down and just work on his skills, as opposed to just being cut by the company. So Nexus now back down to 6, or is it 5? Before we get into anything else here, Skip Sheffield. And I was pretty bummed when I heard this a couple of days ago, but apparently at a Raw House show in Honolulu a couple of days ago, in what I believe was a tag match with Otunga, he suffered some sort of leg injury, which at first some people thought was maybe he rolled his ankle or banged up his knee or something to that effect. As it turns out, we don't know for sure yet, but it sounds as though there may be broken bones involved. Potentially even a broken ankle, although that's not any sort of official diagnosis. Either way, it sounds like his leg is pretty fucked up, and he may need some time off, extended time off, if not surgery, to correct whatever the issue is. If that is true, that sucks. That's no other way to put it. Sheffield is a beast, and he really was put over very strongly in recent weeks as the enforcer of the Nexus faction, the guy that, you know, if he got a hold of you, it was going to be bad times for you. And it's interesting seeing where Sheffield has come from his beginning days on NXT, when he was basically coming out there in a cowboy hat acting like a goof, and now he's turned into somebody who is a genuinely scary specimen. If he is out for an extended period of time, it could not come at a worse time for him in terms of his own career. The question is it a serious enough injury where he can't appear on television? My guess would be if he's going to be off TV for a while, or rather if he's going to need surgery or anything, he's going to be off TV. And if that's the case, do you continue on with 5 Nexus members with Otunga essentially by default becoming your heavy of the group, or do you bring in some new blood? And my first thought, and the first thought of about 90% of you based on comments on SE Scoops and on my Twitter page and emails, is that Husky Harris would be a perfect replacement in NXT, in the Nexus faction for Skip Sheffield, if Skip Sheffield is going to be gone for an extended period of time. You know, Husky Harris, for those of you who missed NXT this week, which is probably most of you, was eliminated from the show. And that's a shame, but it was bound to happen. You know, we're coming down to the nitty-gritty. You've got Alex Riley left. You've got Caval. You've got Mr. Perfect Jr. So Husky was the one who got eliminated along with Percy Watson this week. And he doesn't have a whole hell of a lot to do now that he's off NXT. And so the timing, in a way, could not be more perfect if they wanted to slot him in there. He has made pretty good strides in the ring. I think he's really come into his own. I think the fans, even as a heel, were taking to him. They didn't sound all that pleased when the announcement was made that he was eliminated, which is probably a good sign for him. I'm all for the move. I don't know if that's the direction they want to go in with young Husky. I don't know, but he's impressed me, and he's impressed a lot of people backstage, if you know, these news reports are to be believed. Wrestlers and office people in WWE, very impressed during this NXT season with Husky Harris. So don't count him out as far as possibly being slotted into the Nexus faction if Skip Sheffield is gone. I think it would be a great move, and I would want to keep that Nexus number at 6. I really wouldn't want it to get any lower than that, especially when originally, you know, it was the Nexus 8, and now potentially we're down to the Nexus 5, and they haven't exactly been booked to look too strong of late, so that would be a bad thing, I think, for them to lose one of their members. So hopefully, well, you know, Husky will get a look. Now NXT on Tuesday. So anyway, Raw, not a good show on Monday night. Just did not blow me away at all. NXT, on the other hand, I thought, believe it or not, I actually enjoyed NXT for what it was. It's not a great show. It's an hour long, which I think actually helps. I think if NXT were 2 hours, I would want to shoot myself. And I don't check out every single episode. But what really impressed me on this show, more so than any of the rookies, unfortunately, was Cody Rhodes. That promo that Cody cut at the end of the show when he found out that his rookie, Husky, was eliminated, was phenomenal. I mean, as a promo, if you listen to his words, I mean, it wasn't like the best promo ever, but the fire and the passion that he showed in that promo on that stick was light years ahead of anything you'll ever see out of Ted DiBiase on Raw. And it just goes to show you, you know, DiBiase was supposed to be the golden boy, getting the big push. He got the million-dollar man gimmick, the million-dollar belt. They knew what he lacked in personality. He would need to be made up in other ways, so they paired him off with Maurice. Whatever they're doing on Raw with DiBiase is just not working. But Cody Rhodes, you know, this whole dashing Cody Rhodes gimmick, you know, it's a bunch of camp, you know, and cheese. I think we know that. But that promo he cut on Tuesday night was phenomenal. The fire he showed, telling, you know, Zack Ryder, you know, wishing him well in his future endeavors, and basically calling Layla a whore, you know, healing on the fans. Husky trying to cut his promo that he's entitled to cut as somebody who was just eliminated, and Cody wouldn't let him speak. Cody said, look, I'm going to tell people why you're a big deal. And he goes over to McGillicuddy and insults him. He goes over to Alex Riley and insults him. He goes to insult Caval, kicks him in the gut. It turns into a big brawl. Husky Harris participates in it. Caval eventually comes off the top, hits Husky with his move. Obviously, this whole thing was by design. This was pre-planned in advance as far as Husky not cutting his promo and Cody cutting one, but I thought it was great stuff, and it was actually a different kind of exciting way for NXT to go off the air on Tuesday night. So, two thumbs up, big props to Cody Rhodes. Give that man a push, for crying out loud. A bigger push. So, then there was Impact. Impact. Now, I watched most of that whole effing show last week, and which I talked about in episode... I guess it was 121. I thought that the Motor City Machine Guns Beer Money match was fantastic. Obviously, I was not the only one who felt that way. And, you know, it was what it was. I wasn't impressed by everything on the show. I also had remarked that the first episode of TNA Reaction was not perfect, but I actually enjoyed it. I enjoyed the concept of it. I think WWE should be doing something similar. So, I watched Impact this week, and any goodwill that had been built up from the week before, any positive thoughts I had about the TNA product, pretty much went down the drain this past week. Impact, as a whole, sucked on Thursday night. It was a fucking terrible show. I just don't really know any other way to sugarcoat it. Let's take these things step by step here. Eric Bischoff coming out and announcing that, you know, RVD was basically so severely injured, so mortally wounded, that he would be vacating the TNA World Heavyweight Championship based on those injuries sustained at the hands of Abyss the week before. You know, the man who tried to murder him, basically. You may recall RVD quite literally being left in a pool of blood. It was like a scene out of, like, a Saw movie or something. But whatever. You know, wrestling is all about suspension of disbelief, I suppose. So they strip RVD of the championship because he's so injured. He potentially has holes in his organs. He required something ridiculous, like 120 stitches, something like that. Just talk about taking it to the extreme. Really now. I'm sure what this means is that in 2 months, RVD will be back on TV like nothing ever happened. Of course, for those of you who don't know, the reason RVD is taking some time off from TNA, it's not because of any sort of problem or disagreement or contract expiration or any legitimate injury. He is contracted, as many of the main event guys in TNA are, for a limited number of dates, X number of dates. And the company does not want to exceed that number, or else they have to pay that person more money. And, of course, TNA is in no position to be paying anybody any more money. In fact, they've been cutting people. Homicide, for example, was released by the company this past week. Rosie Lotalove, who was a female performer that TNA had thought would take the role of Awesome Kong as kind of the big dominant female. She's still a relative newcomer in the business. She was trained by Team 3D. Rosie got signed a while back, actually. You may recall Daphne was actually in a match that she was injured in some time ago, and this was the woman who injured her. But she was released by the company. I believe Tyson Tomko was officially let go sometime in the last couple of weeks. So, believe me, TNA is in no position to be paying people more money. Supposedly, Ric Flair, because they're using him on every single TV show. They're burning through all of Ric Flair's dates as well. Flair may be the one guy that they actually do pay money to if they go past that number, because you can't not feature Ric Flair on TV each week if he has his own faction. So, anyway, that's the story with RVD. As far as him being out of TNA for now. So the championship is vacated, and a new champion will be crowned in a tournament that will ultimately culminate in October at the Bound for Glory pay-per-view. Now, one of your first thoughts, perhaps, if you're a TNA fan, would be, well, this essentially nullifies the entire storyline that's been going on now for months of Kurt Angle working his way through the top 10 en route to a championship match. You, in fact, would be correct. So if you have invested your time in following this Kurt Angle storyline, the storyline was essentially killed dead, just like that. Now, that's what happens when you have a change in Booker. Essentially, Tommy Dreamer is assisting now with the booking in TNA because they did not get Paul Heyman, as I predicted they would not. And Dreamer is changing certain things up. He's got his own ideas. Certain storylines will be dropped. New ones will be made. Unfortunately, this was a storyline that, you know, they devoted a lot of time to, that was going on for a while, and it just got dropped, just like that. One of the many reasons that the people in TNA have no fucking idea what they're doing. The best part of Impact to me... even so, did involve Kurt Angle. It was actually the Kurt Angle Doug Williams match, which unfortunately did not go nearly as long as I would have liked for it to. In fact, it was basically just a 5-minute match. But it was one of the best 5 minutes on Impact I've seen in ages, aside maybe from the Machine Guns Beer Money stuff. This was a really fun match. Angle, of course, wins. He gets the tap out with the ankle lock. He advances in the tournament. Chances are he's going to end up winning the entire tournament. The plan all along was for Kurt Angle to burn through the top 10 and eventually win the championship. I would assume plans in that respect have not changed. It's just a shame that the whole storyline got dropped. I mean, even though I love this match, this is a great example here. Doug Williams wasn't even in the top 10, and yet Kurt Angle has to fight him in order to advance in the tournament. It just boggles the mind. But I'm not going to complain because this was a really good match. I enjoyed it. For me, it was the best part of Impact, hands down. No questions asked. Unfortunately, we then got Sting, Kevin Nash, Jeff Jarrett, and Hulk Hogan. Where do I begin? First of all, Kevin Nash. I've always said Kevin Nash is a very personable guy, humorous guy. I have a feeling if I ever met Kevin Nash, hung out with him, that I'd probably like the guy. That being said, one thing that greatly annoys me about him, especially in TNA, are the constant references to, you know, behind-the-scenes bullshit and stuff that nobody in their right mind could ever possibly understand unless you actually work for TNA. We got a lot of that in this interview. We had people threatening to reveal skeletons in the closet of this person and, you know, people. What purpose does any of this serve if 95% of the people listening to this and watching this have no fucking idea what you're talking about? Can you possibly explain this to me? Can somebody explain the logic to me and why I should give a shit that, ooh, there's skeletons in Sting's closet? I mean, unless there's little boys that Sting is hiding in his closet, I don't give a shit what's in Sting's closet. You know, and Nash threatening to tell people what was really going on backstage. Believe me, we all know what's going on backstage in TNA. I mean, it really just explains a lot. That's why TNA's in the shape that it's in. We don't need to know anything more than that. The crowd cannot possibly care less because they didn't understand what was going on. Hogan comes out. He tries to settle things down. You know, eventually the lights went out. Fortune came down. Beat the crap. They left Sting and Nash laying there. You know, which I guess, I don't know if that means all four of them, all four of the veterans now are going to join forces in some sort of faction. I have no idea, but I could not possibly care about any of this, and I don't see how this helps TNA. I don't see why people would care enough to see these guys, you know, team up together. I'm not expecting to see Hogan wrestle at all because he's just in such poor shape physically. I mean, that's part of the reason they abandoned the whole Hogan Abyss program that they were building originally for the October pay-per-view. This was horrendous. This was bad television. Now, what's even worse is that later on in this show, this fucking show, we see Tommy Dreamer and Raven. These two mortal enemies who went at it, they were ripping each other's face open with barbed wire and all the other bullshit at Hardcore Justice, are basically interacting on this show like nothing ever happened between the two of them. It's like, you know, no, they weren't like mortal enemies or anything like that. You know, they didn't want to, you know, kill each other a couple of weeks ago. No. No. It's in the past. Pope beat Matt Morgan in one of the first round tournament matches, which was actually a positive. I was a little worried when I first heard about that match. I figured, all right, well, I guess we know who's going over in this one. So I was pleasantly surprised to see that Pope actually won. Earlier in the show, we saw Jeff Hardy beat Rob Terry, which I suppose was also a good thing. There was some back and forth stuff, you know, earlier between Ric Flair and Mick Foley. Flair, of course, is just a maniac. He's gold on the mic. Foley is, it's funny when we talk about Mick Foley in interviews, because I'm going to get to that in a second, too, a little rant that Mick Foley posted on the TNA website, basically making himself out to look like a whiny little bitch. We'll get to that in a second, but AJ Styles beat Tommy Dreamer at the end of the show. Unfortunately, I did watch Impact. but I did not get to see a reaction this week, so I can't vouch for whether or not it was any better or any worse. I heard from a few people who said it was a little bit better, and that's understandable. It's a relatively new concept. There are some growing pains when you do something for the very first time. Hopefully I'll have an opportunity to check it out next week. But as far as Impact itself, in my opinion, there were a couple of bright spots, namely the Kurt Angle-Doug Williams match. Besides that, fucking horrendous show. I just don't see how any TNA fan could possibly defend some of the bullshit we saw on this show. And that's not to say that you won't see bullshit on Raw or on WWE programming, but the bullshit you see on Impact for some reason just makes me even angrier. And this week, Raw was just a bad show. Impact was a fucking infuriating show. So that's the difference between the two right there. So then we had Friday Night SmackDown. And, it was a good show. It wasn't overly exciting. It didn't blow me away. But there were things to like about SmackDown. So Alberto Alberto Del Rio, that's his name. With the former Dos Caras Jr. is obviously getting the big push. They strapped the rocket to his back, and why not? You know, SmackDown more so than Raw, they need some new faces on that show, and as long as the guy can at least be somewhat serviceable in the ring and not go in there and embarrass himself, then why not? You know, I like the gimmick. He seems to be a heat magnet. I love the Spanish ring announcer who comes out and does his entrance, and boy, did he get put over strong. You know, your debut match, you get a clean submission win over a former world champion in Rey Mysterio. That's pretty big right there. And I don't know if this guy can sustain it. Like I said, his character, his gimmick, the initial push that he's gotten now with a clean win, first night in over Rey Mysterio, all good signs for him. But it's up to him ultimately to deliver. But I liked what I saw from Del Rio this week. I thought the match him and Mysterio had was pretty good. I liked the reversal at the end when Rey went for the 619 into the armbar submission, which practically came out of nowhere. And the crowd, if you listen, you can tell people were legitimately shocked. He made an impression, and hopefully that impression will stick with people, and they'll begin to take him a little more seriously and as a credible threat to people on that roster. You know, the days of making your debut on Superstars or Wrestling Challenge and Wrestling Jobbers for a month or two before moving on to actual, you know, big names, those days, for better or worse, are over. You know, a lot of people now, you make your debut and you're fighting a main eventer in your debut match. Carlito did that, you might remember. I believe in his debut match on SmackDown years ago, Carlito actually fought John Cena and won the United States Championship, if I'm not mistaken. That was his debut match. He had a little bit of help in that match, I believe, from a chain, if I'm not mistaken. There was some sort of interference or a foreign object or something that Carlito used. So his victory wasn't as clean as Del Rio's was this week. But, there are examples to point to. And Carlito was one of those guys who could have been and should have been a much bigger deal. And he kind of screwed himself over. But I liked what I saw in the main event. Now, as far as the World Heavyweight Champion is concerned, Undertaker did make his return at SummerSlam. He was not on SmackDown this week. He'll be on the show next week. Obviously, they're building to a program between him and Undertaker for the title. Supposedly, it will go through the Hell in a Cell pay-per-view in October. But Kane came out and basically talked on the microphone for 10 straight minutes. Now, under normal circumstances, this would bother me. I'm not a big fan of people coming out and rambling on for 10 minutes straight. We used to get that every single week from Triple H during the dark days. I don't really think anybody enjoyed that. But I have to say, this was one of the best promos that I have ever heard Kane cut in his career. I'm not a big fan of the background music. It's a bit too cheesy for my taste. But believe it or not, I actually felt that it worked in this case. I'm not sure the promo would have been as effective without the background music, so I still don't like it, but it actually worked, as corny as it is. The material that Kane is given with the big words and everything, far too often I hear these promos and it sounds to me like I'm being read some sort of Shakespeare novel, courtesy of the WWE creative team. Not a big fan of that. But again, just the way that he pulled it off was fantastic. And who would have ever thought? I mean, here's a guy who, for years and years, part of his whole gimmick was that he couldn't speak. And who would have known that 12 years later, you know, this guy would be on SmackDown cutting the kind of promos that we heard him cut on Friday night. He sounded eloquent. He sounded articulate, which he is in real life. You know, there were parts where he was laughing and he would scream and he would raise his voice. But for the most part, he was pretty even-keeled and spoke like a real human being during this promo. But it was very effective, I thought. And like I said, one of the best Kane promos I've ever heard him cut, and how he can memorize all that material and all those words. You know, Kane, I wouldn't call him a master thespian, although I did enjoy See No Evil. But for him to memorize all that and just pull it off the way that he did, my hat's off to him. It was a great, great promo, and I'm just riding the wave. I'm enjoying Kane's push while it lasts. Obviously, he's not going to be champion. I don't think he's going to be champion for that many more months. You know, it's probably the last big push of his career, and he's deserved it. I never thought he would get it. I had moved on, figuring it was never going to happen, and it's been a pleasant surprise. You know, he deserves it, and I'm anxious to see where they go with this. Obviously, the storyline is Undertaker has been weakened. Whatever Kane did to him and putting him in a vegetative state has weakened the Undertaker, and I would hope that's the storyline, because he looked, like I said on Sound Off 121 with my SummerSlam review, God, did the Undertaker look old at the pay-per-view, and he looked fucking terrible. So we'll see where they go with this. The other thing I want to just mention, the Kofi Kingston-Dolph Ziggler match was like every other Kofi-Dolph match you'll ever see, but I was impressed and somewhat disturbed by the viciousness of that foot stomp on Kofi's face at the end of that match. When that match was over and he had already put Kofi out, he came back into the ring, Dolph did, and lifted his boot very slowly over Kofi's face and then just stomped the shit out of poor Kofi. So vicious was it, in my infinite wisdom, which just goes to show you my level of maturity still has a way to go here. For some odd reason, I decided, you know, I wonder what that feels like. And I decided to lift my hand up and smack myself in the face as hard as I could to try to replicate the viciousness of the stomp. And that was not a good move. We almost didn't get a sound off this weekend because my jaw has been aching. And, if you know, I haven't told anybody that because I could just picture myself telling somebody, yeah, my jaw hurts, and them asking me, well, why? And my response, if I was to be honest with them, would have to be, well, you see, I was watching TV, and I decided to smack myself in the face. Don't do that, everybody. Don't smack yourself in the face. But it was a vicious stomp. I like the mean streak that Dolph has been showing lately. He just has to change that name because I don't think I could ever take him seriously with that name. So, there you go. That's your week in wrestling TV, a rare week where I was pretty much able to catch most, if not all, of every show. And I guess when you really look at the week as a whole, it wasn't the best week to be a wrestling fan as far as what we saw on TV. Like I said, the Del Rio push on SmackDown is very encouraging, although it's way too early to see how he progresses with it. But at least they're giving somebody an opportunity. The Kane promo was great. You know, the Kurt Angle match for the 5 minutes that it lasted on Impact was good stuff. The rest of Impact fucking blew. NXT was fine. The ending I liked. And Raw, well, Raw was just not that good. And hopefully they can build the Nexus back up. Like I said, if Skip Sheffield is going to be out for an extended period of time, I'd rather see them plug in somebody like a Husky Harris in that slot to just keep the number at 5 or take, a current WWE superstar or something like that and plug them in there. Raw, by the way, as I mentioned earlier, they taped 2 shows this past week, so Raw is in the can. They are touring China right now. I believe they were in Japan, now they're in China, so they had to tape the show in advance. I'm not going to run the spoilers down, other than to say that Darren Young, in fact, did not show up on Raw this week. So don't expect him to be back anytime soon. But for those of you who want to know the spoilers, you can find them on elsewhere on SEScoops.com. There was a big match made for the Night of Champions pay-per-view coming up in September. I believe it's, I want to say September 19th, I believe, is the date of the next pay-per-view. And it is going to be a 6-pack challenge for the WWE Championship, which is interesting in that it was about 11 years ago, in September of 1999, that we saw the very first six-pack challenge on a WWE pay-per-view. You may recall that was the vacant championship. That was when Vince McMahon pinned Triple H on SmackDown to become champ, and then he vacated the belt. Steve Austin was the outside enforcer. It was Rock, Mankind, Big Show, Triple H, British Bulldog, and Kane, I believe, were the participants in that match. But, yeah, we're going to get a six-pack challenge at the Night of Champions. Orton will be in there. Sheamus, obviously, defending the title. I believe Jericho and Edge, Wade Barrett, and Cena, I believe. So, that's your Raw news there. Couple of other quick bits here. Bobby Lashley, former ECW champion, WWE headliner, competed for Strikeforce last night. He was going into this fight undefeated against a relative nobody. I guess I shouldn't say nobody. I mean, the guy, I guess, you know, some people knew who he was, but he wasn't exactly a big name in the world of mixed martial arts. Let's just put it that way. A man by the name of Chad Griggs, who Lashley should have been able to defeat easily, and unfortunately for Bobby, that did not happen. In fact, Lashley got his ass kicked, got a pretty bad laceration on his eye, lost the fight. After the second round, actually, it was stopped. So he didn't get knocked out or anything like that, but he still lost and had to be rushed to the hospital. I believe he's okay. Not sure where they're going to go now. The big rumor before this loss was that they were going to try to put together a Bobby Lashley-Dave Batista fight. Batista is in serious training right now and has not signed a contract with Strikeforce, but the rumor is that he will. And, you know, I still think even though Lashley lost, if anything, a fight with Batista now makes more sense. I think if Lashley would have won, he would have stayed undefeated. He's looking for more serious competition. Big Dave, God bless him, if he gets into MMA, he's not serious competition. Not yet, anyway. It would have made less sense for Lashley to take that fight had he won. Now that he lost, if Lashley is intent on kind of dusting himself off and getting back in the hunt, why not take a fight with Big Dave Batista and maybe lay waste to him? Of course, if Batista walked into MMA and beat up Lashley, that would not be good for Bobby Lashley's career. So, not sure where they're going to go with this, but I guess we shall see. The other interesting thing is the other rumor that Paul Heyman is on the cusp of potentially signing with Strikeforce, which would kill all the hopes and dreams of Dixie Carter if that were to happen. So, nothing official. But we will continue to watch the Heyman story. And I think whoever Heyman ends up going with, if it's in MMA, if it's in wrestling, it'll be a benefit to that organization because Paul Heyman's a smart guy. He's probably more passionate about MMA these days, in all honesty, than he is pro wrestling. And I think he'll be nothing but a big boon to whatever promotion he signs with. Now, I just have a couple of quick comments here about Mick Foley, and then we'll break into your feedback here. Mick Foley posted a long, and I do mean a long, diatribe on the TNA website a couple of days ago. So long, in fact, that I'm just shocked he didn't bother having it published in hardcover. Basically complaining about comments that have been made by one Dave Meltzer. Dave Meltzer is the preeminent wrestling journalist. He has been now for over 25 years. His newsletter is great. I would highly recommend a subscription to it. I wouldn't be half as knowledgeable, you know, in wrestling news as I like to think I am if it wasn't for the Wrestling Observer. People in the business read it. People who won't admit to reading it actually read it. It's always been that way. In fact, one of the all-time classic moments back in 1995, I believe it was, 94-95, was on a WCW, I believe it was the Clash of the Champions, where Hulk Hogan is doing an interview segment. Sting is there, and I think Gene Okerlund was conducting the interview. You can find it on YouTube. And Hogan actually physically burns a copy of the Wrestling Observer newsletter. Thin skin do we have, Hulk? Anyway, Foley was upset that Meltzer in recent months has not been the biggest fan of Mick Foley's promos. Which is not entirely true, I have to say. I mean, Meltzer has said good things about the promos that Mick has done, But I think the general consensus, and this is not just with Meltzer, I mean, ask anybody whether you're a TNA fan or not, Mick Foley being in TNA is not doing his legacy any favors. You know, you could look at a guy like Kurt Angle and say, you know what, leaving WWE and going to TNA may have been the best thing for Kurt's career, maybe for his life. Working that schedule in WWE and the pressures and everything that he was doing at the time, you know, Kurt Angle probably would not be alive today. I mean, that it just wasn't sustainable. Going to TNA, he works fewer dates, he's free to do movies and other things, he looks healthier, probably feels healthier. He'll never be 100%, but it was probably good for Kurt Angle for him to go to TNA. But Mick Foley going to TNA, noble as it was for him to want to go and try to help this little promotion, it's not doing his legacy any favors. Having him wrestling all the time after he first came to TNA, I mean, you know, the thought was that Mick would come in and, you know, sure, he'd do a match every now and then, but, I mean, they were having Foley wrestle every week at one point. It was ridiculous, and I don't want to say that Mick Foley has become a joke or that he can't cut a good promo anymore, because he absolutely could. I mean, Foley is still one of the best promo guys in the business. We just don't get a real opportunity, I think, to see that in TNA so much, and some of the promos that he has cut recently are, in all honesty, not the best Mick Foley promos that I've ever heard, and it's kind of disappointing to hear Foley go on and on and on and on and on about this, because it just makes him sound so incredibly insecure. You know, if you go, just, I'm not going to summarize the whole thing because it's so goddamn long, but, you know, go ahead and read it if you've got a couple of hours to kill, and you'll see what I'm talking about. I mean, he talks early on in his diatribe about how, you know, this particular year, I think it was 94, in the Observer, I think I was voted best promo guy. You don't think you were voted best promo guy. You know you were voted best promo guy. Why do you have to say, oh, I think I was? Just admit it. You care about that stuff. You care about it. Maybe a little too much. And it just makes Mick look pretty fucking terrible, I have to say. It makes him look like a whiny little bitch. And I never really thought of Mick Foley as being a whiny little bitch or somebody who was incredibly insecure about their ability. I mean, Mick Foley doesn't have to worry about anybody second-guessing him as a promo guy. I mean, you know, you're just not as... I can't even say he's not as good as he once was. I just don't think, you know, the opportunity has been there recently for him to cut that one big great promo, which, you know, he's had good promos in TNA, but so what? You're not the best promo guy anymore. Who cares? Why does it matter to Mick Foley that Dave Meltzer doesn't give 5 stars to his promos anymore? Who gives a fuck? Why does Mick Foley care? Why does he have to write 10,000 words on the TNA website? And again, it's one of those things where if you're a TNA fan and you're not, you know, an inside fan, if you don't even know what these newsletters are, most people probably don't even know who the fuck Dave Meltzer is. So why this goes on the TNA website, people are reading this, and God knows what they must be thinking as they're reading this. It's just, I'm just amazed that he actually wrote that and put that up there. So Mick Foley needs to just not worry so much about what other people think about him. And he needs to worry more about what he's doing to his legacy in TNA. Because unlike a Kurt Angle, who I think for him it was a good career move and a good life move on his part, for Mick Foley, I don't think this move to TNA has been a good one for him, to say the least. I think it's done nothing but damage him. There is nothing special about Mick Foley anymore as a draw. In fact, I don't think he is a draw. I don't think he's been a draw since the day he set foot in TNA. And Foley has not, to me, felt special at all since the Randy Orton feud from 2004 in WWE. In all honesty, that may have been the last great match that Mick had in the last time that he truly felt like a special entity or draw in any way, was that match with Orton. And that was over 6 years ago. And that's a shame. All right, so let's get to your feedback, which is really all that matters, what you guys think. Break into the mailbag here. A quick comment here before we get to the sound-off mailbag. There is now an official SE Scoops mailbag. The first mailbag feature went up this past Wednesday. The hope is that we'll do at least one, maybe more than one each week. And for that, you can submit your questions to sescoops@gmail.com. For those of you who asked, yes, it was me who put that mailbag up. I'll be answering most of the questions there, as well as my own questions here for the sound-off. So if you have anything specifically for this podcast, still send those in to the Solomonster podcast@gmail.com. So on that note, let's break into some stuff. Here we have Luis writing in a couple of questions. Solomonster, what do you think of Paul Heyman's tenure as a color commentator in WWF in 2001? I thought he was great. Heyman and Jim Ross had this tension between them that was real, quite frankly, and it made for good television. I did get very nostalgic after a while for Jerry Lawler to come back, which is kind of funny now looking back on that because Lawler is so... I still like the King, but I think he needs a rest. I really do. Or maybe it's just that Michael Cole has soured me so much on that Raw announce team. I'm not quite sure, but I thought Heyman did a great job back in 01. Second question here from Luis. Would Webmaster Mike of SC Scoops be interested in paying or help with paying for bandwidth so that all of your old sound ops could be posted on the website? Well, I'm going to leave that question open-ended. I'll leave that question up to Webmaster Mike, if he's listening, to answer. James writes in. He is not as happy with Impact, either, from this past Thursday night. He says, "Dear Solomonster, head and spinal trauma, 115 stitches and possibly punctured organs. To quote The Miz, really, this has to be the worst injury angle ever. No one who suffers this injury would ever return to normal life, much less wrestle again later this year, which you know is going to happen. Who jumped the shark? TNA did." Matt Hardy wrote into the Sound Off here. Yes, indeed. Matthew Hardy, "Dear Solomonster, been listening since Sound Off 112. Can't believe I didn't listen before. Awesome show always. Two questions here. Number one, I think it's possible that Vince McMahon is in fact planning war games for Survivor Series. I know you doubt it, but I think it could happen based purely on the fact that they are keeping the Survivor Series name. Perhaps Vince has realized that fans like the surprise of a match stipulation being announced, rather than it being forecast by the name of a pay-per-view. These gimmick matches mean so much more if there is a build-up to it. What are your thoughts?" Well, you can say that for anything. I mean, anything with the proper build is going to mean more, even if it's just the basic one-on-one feud between two guys. You know, if you have two pay-per-views that are separated by 3 weeks, as opposed to promoting a big match on a pay-per-view, let's say, where there's 6 or 8 weeks between the shows, you know, the longer promotion that you have, it's going to mean more to your bottom line. I mean, that's just basic math. So, yeah, when you have a pay-per-view in advance that's called Money in the Bank, I mean, that may be a bad example to use, actually, because Money in the Bank, the actual pay-per-view buy rate for that is not in yet, but it sounds like Money in the Bank probably did pretty good. I guess we'll find out, but not a big fan of the gimmick pay-per-views. I see your point. If they just wait and maybe a month before Survivor Series they announce that they're going to do a War Games match, I guess that's fine. I'm still not expecting them to do that, though. I would love it, but I just don't see it happening. Second question here. The bigger picture or leader of the Nexus needs to be Michael Cole. It explains why Bryan Danielson was kicked out and provides a means for his return. He has a legitimate gripe with WWE for not being respected and taken seriously as an announcer, and because he is always undermined when superstars call JR the best announcer ever. Also, I feel if a big star like Cena or Triple H are revealed as the mastermind, it will diminish the progress Nexus have made and change the focus to that star and not the new characters like Barrett and Sheffield. All good points. I'm not going to argue with any of those points, but I am past the point of believing that Michael Cole is going to be the leader of Nexus. I actually have an easier time believing that Michael Cole may be revealed as the anonymous GM. You know, like one day he just kind of gets to the podium after that stupid text messaging chime goes off and pretends that he's reading off the laptop, and maybe, you know, a wrestler will get pissed off and they'll rush out of the ring over to the podium where Cole is, and they'll see that there is, in fact, there is no message on the laptop, and then everyone kind of looks at Cole, like in this moment of this revelation when they see that there is no text message or email from the GM, they look at Cole, who has this expression on his face that turns to a smirk, or something like that. I just came up with that on my own, but as far as Cole being the leader of Nexus, I just think we're beyond that point, you know? I just don't see it happening, but anonymous GM? Yeah. I think that's definitely a possibility. Chris writes into the Sound Off here, "Dear Solomonster, on the last episode you talked about segments featuring stare downs that do not lead to anything. I agree, we see them all too often. Anyway, the one that really pissed me off and the one I wanted to see the most was Triple H and JBL, back when they were world champions. They were the top champs, and they had their respective factions. I really wish they would have had something like Champion versus Champion, or perhaps the Cabinet against Evolution. In my opinion, the brand separation meant more at that time, as did a Champion versus Champion match. Well, it might have meant a little bit more, but in all honesty, Champion versus Champion hasn't meant anything probably in like a decade. And that's part of what happens, you know. At one point, you had three world titles. Not that anybody ever really took that ECW belt seriously, but I still think they need to consolidate the belts into one world title, similar to what they've done with the tag belts. And by the way, how could I forget about this? On Raw Monday night, Bret Hart coming down to the ring with those two new tag team championship belts. Those may be the most god-awful looking belts I've ever seen. I just was amazed when I saw that. You can't even call them gold. They look bronze. Just not a fan of those belts at all. I can understand why they wanted to get rid of the other ones. Hart Dynasty having to carry those things around through airports was probably a big pain in the ass. But that's the best you could do, really? Those belts are the best that you could possibly do? I had a nasty stomach bug the other day. And was not having a very pleasant evening, let's say. And I looked down in the toilet, and what I saw in the toilet was better looking than those tag team belts. And I'm not even exaggerating. There's a visual for you. See, nothing but class. Nothing but class here on the Sound Off. Bill writes into the podcast feeling that the Daniel Bryan thing had to have been a work, and here's why. How much sense would it have made logically to have forgotten to tell Bryan Danielson that there was a choke ban because of the Benoit tragedy, yet allow him to do Chris Benoit's signature finisher, the crossface? I think it's kind of a weak argument to point to a choke ban because of one person for firing a person, then turn around and allow them to use the same person's finisher. Maybe you can logically explain it. First of all, the two have nothing to do with each other. And second of all, this would be the equivalent of saying, well, Chris Benoit used to use a power bomb as his finishing maneuver. That's like saying, if Psycho Sid truly went psycho and went out and shot up a mall and killed 15 people and then shot himself in the head, that because of this, nobody could ever again use the power bomb as a finishing maneuver. That's just fucking stupid. That makes no sense. The whole choke thing, I mean, that had more to do with the media than anything else, and the fact that he basically choked his young son to death. There's a big difference between that and a finishing maneuver that the man uses on television. And I don't want to get into this again. I mean, there were you know, rumors that it was actually a variation of the crossface maneuver that he used on his son. I don't know. You don't know. Nobody knows. I don't want to know. All I can tell you is that this goes beyond Daniel Bryan, much earlier than this. In fact, within a year or so of the Benoit stuff that happened in 07, maybe even later that same year, we were already seeing Shawn Michaels using the crossface as a move in his matches. So, like I said, the two are two totally separate things. And it really doesn't prove anything. It doesn't prove that it's a work at all. I mean, you could point maybe to other things to lend credence to your argument. That would not be the first thing that I would think of to point to. Oh, you know, Danielson uses the crossface, so therefore this whole thing must have been a work. No, it doesn't work that way. Jack wrote into the Sound Off with a long email. Some good stuff in there, Jack. Last question that he had here at the end of the email is an interesting one. Could we, basically, the crux of the question is this, and I'm paraphrasing here. Could we see Randy Orton undergo a full-fledged face turn? Now, I'm going to stop you there, Jack. There's no reason to turn Orton face. He already is a face. You know, it's kind of similar to Steve Austin and Batista in that there was no one great epiphany that this wrestler had that turned them babyface. It was a gradual thing over time where the fans dictated as such. So there's no reason to turn Orton. He's already been turned, whether he likes it or not. But the idea here is that could we see Orton as a babyface, as he is now, up against a heel John Cena in a main event of WrestleMania? First of all, I really don't have any interest in seeing another John Cena-Randy Orton match, but I will give you this. The dynamic of having Orton as the babyface and Cena as the heel is intriguing to me, And as much as I really just don't want to see this match ever again, they still are the two biggest superstars on that roster. And Orton and Cena in a WrestleMania main event is not out of the realm of possibility because they are two of the biggest stars. And I think that match would mean something as far as pay-per-view buys are concerned. But again, we've just seen it so many times that, to me, they've ruined it. I just have no interest in seeing those two one-on-one ever again as long as I live. Brock writes in, why doesn't WWE have their pay-per-views in HD? I mean, am I just spoiled, or does it look like YouTube-quality garbage? I think you might just be spoiled, because WWE does, in fact, have their pay-per-views in HD. They charge an extra $10 for it. I do not have an HD TV. I know I'm stuck in the Stone Age, so I can't vouch for the quality of it, but I can guarantee you that they do offer HD feeds. So unless your cable operator for some reason isn't offering it, in which case, sucks to be you, you got to move. But they definitely offer their pay-per-views in HD. Tyler writes in, Dear Solid Monster, my question is about Randy Orton. Do you think Orton has a little too much backstage power? The deep push of Kofi Kingston and Evan Bourne on Raw and the deep push of Jack Swagger on SmackDown are all reportedly due to Orton throwing temper tantrums at them backstage. I think it is very uncalled for. What do you think? First of all, this is the first I'm hearing of Orton having anything to do with a deep push of Evan Bourne or Jack Swagger. Don't believe everything you read on the internet. Even on SE Scoops every now and then, there will be a rumor or a nugget that turns out to not be true. And it's not SE Scoops' fault, but it becomes widespread across many different wrestling websites, and it turns out to be utter and complete bullshit. And surprise, surprise, on occasion there are other wrestlers backstage who have their own agendas, who will float pieces of information that are false to the websites to try to taint somebody else or to try to muddy the waters or what have you. That may be the case here. Maybe some people are jealous, perhaps, of Randy Orton. Now, I'm not going to say the Orton rumors are not true in that he has a bad temper. Of course, the biggest example I could think of is Mr. Kennedy, the current Mr. Anderson, who was in a match with Orton, dropped Orton on the back of his head. Orton, who has had issues before with a broken clavicle, was not happy about that. And he chewed out Anderson in front of everybody backstage. And many people think ultimately Orton's actions got him fired, Mr. Kennedy. So that is true, and Orton has actually commented on that before on his website, I believe. But I never heard of Randy Orton having anything to do with a deep push of Evan Bourne. I mean, if anything, him and Bourne are friends backstage, and they actually pulled off a tremendous feat a couple of weeks back, if you remember that RKO out of, Airborne. It was just a phenomenal move, you know, to see Evan Bourne flying through the air, doing his move, and then to get caught in midair in the RKO. I know both those guys were really proud and happy of the way that turned out. There's no reason that Orton would complain about Evan Bourne in any way. And as far as Jack Swagger is concerned, the prevailing rumor there, which has nothing to do with Orton, and think about it, unless it happened at a pay-per-view or something where all the rosters are backstage, Orton and Swagger are on two totally different brands. So why Orton would be backstage on SmackDown bitching about anything that Jack Swagger does doesn't make any sense. The thing about Swagger is supposedly a couple weeks back, he was found sleeping, I believe, backstage during one of the shows, and that kind of rubbed people the wrong way, and that might have something to do with his deep push of late. But it definitely, in his case anyway, does not have anything to do with Randy Orton. Brad from Bloomsburg, Pennsylvania writes in, been a listener since episode 19 and been watching WWF nonstop since just before WrestleMania 3. Anyway, Brad says, as I was watching the Raw rebound on SmackDown, I had a great idea. No one cares about Darren Young, so the next time we see him, he should cut his hair like John Cena and do the old-school rapper gimmick. He would have to wear the jean shorts, and I know how much you love the jean shorts, Solomon Monster. The NFL or NBA jersey, the chain around the neck, his music could be the basic Thugonomics theme that Cena used to come out to. This would either make people cheer for the stupid comedy or boo and hate him. At least it's better than nobody caring about him. What do you think? You know, at the beginning of the email when you said that you had a great idea? There's just one problem. You forgot to put the great idea in the email. But as for the idea that you did put here in the email, Yeah, I don't think that's such a wise move for Darren Young's career. Bethany writes into the podcast, longtime listener, discovered your podcast around episode 8 or 9. I hope you can provide some insights into my question here. It's regarding Buff Bagwell and Scott Steiner returning to WWE for one final run. What would it take for them to get one last chance? They could enter as the last of the WCW and do an outsider's gimmick, which would culminate at WrestleMania. In particular, I feel Buff deserves one last chance. What would it take for him to get back into the WWE for more than just one match? Oh, Bethany, Bethany, Bethany. I like you, Bethany, I do. And I appreciate you listening to the podcast as long as you have been, but this may be one of the worst ideas that I have ever heard. Just the notion of Buff Bagwell and Scott Steiner coming back to WWE as the last vestiges of World Championship Wrestling in 2010 makes me chuckle. That's not how I would frame it, even if I liked the idea. I would not be bringing them in as the last of WCW. I think we saw the last of WCW, unless you watch Impact every week, which is basically WCW Reborn. We basically saw the end of WCW 9 years ago. Nobody wants to see it anymore. The reason that Buff Bagwell and Scott Steiner are not on WWE television is because nobody wants to see them either. Now, Steiner, I'll give him his due. He actually looked better in the ring in TNA than he ever did during his WWE run. His body is slowly breaking down, but then again, he's in his late 40s, so that's what happens when you get older and when you're all jacked up the way that he is. But much respect to Scott Steiner, because those last days in TNA, he was busting his ass every single week, busting out a Frankensteiner. I mean, really just impressive stuff. And doing stuff that at his age and his physical condition, he should not be doing. Now, Buff Bagwell, I have never heard anybody say anything similar about Buff Bagwell, about how he hustled or how he always gave it 100%. He always busted his ass. He, you know, what a waste of talent. He could have been a world champion. I've never heard anybody say that about Buff Bagwell. And there's a reason for that, because Buff is full of his own stuff, if you catch my drift. And nobody in general, let alone anybody backstage in wrestling, likes somebody who walks around with a chip on their shoulder, who thinks their shit don't stink when they're really not that fucking good. And Buff Bagwell got a big run in WCW. He could have, in all honesty, gotten a much bigger run. You may remember when Buff got hurt, and he was in that match with the Steiner brothers, and he basically broke his neck. And a couple months later, they brought him back, and he was, you know, I think he was in a wheelchair or whatever the case may be, and he was primed and positioned to be a big-time babyface. And I don't know if he would have been able to run with it. I don't know how successful he would have been with it, but there was a real opportunity for them to turn him into a big babyface player. And instead, they decided to do, you know, the big turn, the big swerve, and they put him, you know, with the NWO, and after that, nobody really gave a shit about Buff Bagwell. And towards the end of WCW, when guys were pretty much doing whatever they wanted, nobody was motivated. I can't blame Buff entirely, because, you know, being part of that environment, who could possibly care? So why should he? But again, the stories and the rumors of him and the likes of Lex Luger just acting unprofessional in the ring, you know, not giving a damn, not making their opponents look good at all. In fact, going out of their way to make them look stupid. And Buff didn't exactly have a sterling reputation during his brief run in WWF. There were rumors of his mother, Judy, who, yes, was a former WCW tag team champion during the Russo days. His mother would call the company and, you know, I forgot all the stories about what she was claiming, but just the biggest bunch of BS I ever heard. He's more of a headache than he's worth. I know you like Buff. He's a great gimmick on the independents. That seems to work for him. He still does indie work. He's done interviews in recent years where he still talks about the fact that he's on, I think, pain medication. He's on different types of pills because his neck is still fucked up. I actually recall listening to Buff doing an interview last year where he said he still wrestles because it helps his neck feel better. Believe it or not, when he competes and the more he actually wrestles in that ring, it makes his neck feel better, which to me sounds a little bizarre. I guess the logic there being that as long as he stays active, the neck won't stiffen up on him, but it sounds to me like physically he's still a wreck. Who even knows if he would pass a wellness examination to get into WWE? But the notion of him and Steiner coming in together in some kind of big angle that culminates at WrestleMania, absolutely not. That would be a terrible idea, and nobody would care. It would not mean a thing for business, and that's exactly why WWE doesn't do it. Don't think for a second that if Vince McMahon didn't think he could make money off either one of those guys, he wouldn't make a pitch for them right now, because they are available. You know, Buff's probably sitting by the telephone right now. There's a reason that TNA even has not given Buff Bagwell a second look. So that right there should tell you everything you need to know about that. And let's see here. Lastly, we have Richard from New York City. Been an avid listener since episode 35. He has a question here. After what happened at SummerSlam, after Kane's awesome promo on SmackDown as well, do you think that WWE is doing enough to make us interested in the renewed Kane-Undertaker rivalry? I think they're doing what they can do, because this rivalry has been done to death so many times before. There's not much left they can do, quite frankly. The twist of Undertaker being weakened and not being able to be the Undertaker that we have known him to be, and that Kane has some sort of power over him, or at least physically now has more power than him, and the promo that Kane cut, you know, 15 years he's been waiting for this day, and even when they were reunited there and they were a tag team for a while, he was just kind of waiting for the opportunity. I mean, it's all bullshit, obviously. It's revisionist history, but I kind of respect the way they handled that promo. At least some of the stuff made sense. I think they're doing everything they could do. You know, it's only been 2 weeks. Actually, it hasn't even been a full 2 weeks. It's been a week since SummerSlam. So it's still very early to tell. I guess, you know, Undertaker will be back on TV next week. We'll see where they go with that. But I think they're doing everything they could do for a rivalry that they have no business revisiting, because it's been done to death ever since 1997. Think about it. This goes back to 1997. And in 2010, they're trying to put a different spin on it, which I can respect that, trying to make it different in some way. I would not have gone back to this feud in the first place, but being that they have, they're trying. And that's really all that you can ask for. I've said this for a long time. I think by this point, it's way too late. You know, a couple of years ago, this would have worked. I really think this would have worked. And I've talked about it on this podcast at least once. I know I made this comment before on this show, that I always thought it would be neat to have introduced a sister of Destruction. So however they would have gone about doing it, introduce a sister character for Kane and The Undertaker that neither one of them, or at least Undertaker, never knew even existed. And the key there would be to find the right person to play the role. I always thought before she went back to TNA that Daphne, for example, would be a good fit for that. But you find the right person to play the role, and you introduce this new wrinkle in the family tree of Kane and The Undertaker, and you give them a sister. I mean, to me, people would have had a real interest in that. And if she was a performer who could also go in the ring and she could wrestle, that would just make it all the more better. By now, I think it's just been way too long. It would be incredibly, you know, not impossible to believe, but hard to believe in the first place to introduce this sister out of nowhere. But to do so now in 2010, that ship has already sailed, unfortunately. But I always thought that would be a nice little storyline arc if they ever wanted to go in that direction. But I guess it was not to be. So that's going to do it for the mailbag. Cinch this bad boy up. As always, you can email your questions into thesolemonster@gmail.com. That, of course, is separate from the new SE Scoops mailbag, which is seScoops@gmail.com. We'll be doing another one this week, by the way, at least one. And those questions are to be answered on the website. These questions here for this podcast are answered on the air, so you can email me directly. Follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/Solemonster. Facebook me at facebook.com/TheSolemonster. And you can download the show, as always, for free via iTunes. So until next time, be well, stay safe. We'll see you right back here next weekend for Sound Off 123 on SEScoops.com. Have a good one, guys.
You've been listening to The Sama Monster.
You know, I really just don't understand what they're doing.
Anybody agree with me out there? I mean, anybody. Come on, throw me a bone here.
Probably the single dumbest thing I've ever seen in my entire life.
God, I love this business.
On SEScoops.com.